Good day and welcome to the Rural Health Clinic's Technical Assistance National Teleconference. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Bill Finnerfrock. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator, and I want to welcome everyone to today's Rural Health Clinic's National Teleconference call. Today we'll be talking and doing a regulatory update on a couple of different rules that are in various stages of development or conclusion that are of interest to the RHC community. Joining me today in presenting information will be Gail Nickerson. Gail is the Vice President of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and she also serves as a representative on the negotiated rulemaking committee that Gail is going to be talking about a little bit later. I want to welcome everyone to today's call and appreciate you taking the time to be with us. My name is Bill Finnerfrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. I will be providing remarks in addition to Gail. The format for today's program will consist of about 45 minutes for presentation, and then Gail and I will be available to take questions. If we run short, that means we just have a little bit more time for questions. This series of calls is sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is held in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. The purpose of the series is to provide rural health clinic staff with valuable technical assistance and RHC-specific information. Today's call is the 41st in the series, which began in late 2004, and during that time, over 11,000 individuals have participated in the bi-monthly RHC National Teleconference calls. As you all know, there's no charge to participate in this series, and we encourage you to refer others who might benefit from the information to sign up to receive announcements regarding dates, topics, and speaker presentations. You can direct folks to www.hrsa.gov/rural-health/policy/CONFCALL/index.html. During the Q&A period, we do ask that you identify yourself by name as well as the city and state that you're calling from. If you have questions after the call or you want to recommend topics for future calls, you can send those via email to info@narhc.org and put RHCTA question in the subject line. That concludes the opening remarks, so I will kick it off here first. And I wanted to update you all on a couple of regulations that are of particular interest to the Rural Health Clinics community. First, by way of background, some of you may know that in June of 2008, specifically June 27th, 2008, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a very wide-ranging and extensive proposed rule making a number of changes in the Rural Health Clinics program, not least of which was language which would have allowed the secretary to decertify rural health clinics that were no longer located in rural areas or in shortage areas, whether they be health professional shortage areas, medically underserved areas, or an area that was designated by the governor as underserved that were no longer valid or were out of date. The proposed rule would have also established a mechanism by which clinics in those situations could have sought a waiver of that decertification by demonstrating to the secretary that the clinic continued to be essential to the availability of care in that community despite the fact that it was no longer designated as either rural or underserved. In addition, the proposed rule would have established a mandatory quality assurance program improvement initiative, made changes in the program relative to the calculation of rural health clinic payments and how they are affected by the beneficiary's copay and deductible from Medicare, and made other technical or conforming changes to the Rural Health Clinic program to reflect statutory changes that have been made over the years. As I said, that proposed rule was issued on June 27th of 2008. Federal law requires that in order for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to publish a final rule subsequent to the issuance of a proposed rule, that final rule has to be released and finalized within 3 years of the date of the issuance of the proposed rule. That means that the proposed rule that was issued on June 27th of 2008 had to be finalized by June 27th of 2011 this past Monday. That did not occur. Consequently, the proposed rule that had been put forward that we had NARHC and others had commented on, had been tracking and monitoring very closely, has been rescinded and is now dead. There is no longer any proposed changes pending with regard to the Rural Health Clinic program, and any changes will have to, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will have to go back to the drawing board and seek to potentially develop a new proposed rule, which would then at some point be published in the Federal Register. We don't know when that may occur. We don't anticipate that that will occur anytime soon, but that is somewhat speculative on our part. As you can imagine, if you do the math, 2008 was the very end of the Bush administration. The Obama administration was not particularly, it seems, enamored with some of the proposals that were put forth by the Bush administration, and in many cases we think that that had an impact on the decision not to issue this final rule. So anyone who, clinics who were out there who were worried about the possibility of being decertified because you're no longer in a shortage area or being decertified because you're no longer in a rural area, that is not looming over your head in the immediate future. And so, because the statute, which authorized the secretary to establish a mechanism for decertification, also stipulated that that authority could not be exercised until such time as the secretary put rules in place by which clinics could seek designation as an essential provider. So as we stand here today, there are no changes that are going to occur in the Rural Health Clinics program based on the proposed rule. That has been rescinded. There are some other proposed rules that are out there that I wanted to make you aware of. One has to do with the e-prescribing initiative. As many of you may know, a few years ago, the federal government created incentives to encourage providers to begin e-prescribing rather than using paper prescriptions, and a bonus payment was available to providers who bill using the fee schedule. Could get a slight increase in their fee schedule payments if they could demonstrate that they were e-prescribers. That program will now transition to a penalty program, and that has caused some questions with regard to the applicability of penalties to the Rural Health Clinics program. I wanted to make people aware that, in addition, the bonus payment that was available was not payable to Rural Health Clinics because RHCs do not bill using the fee schedule. By the same token, the penalty that is now going to be come into play later in early 2012 will not apply to Rural Health Clinics. Rural Health Clinic services are not part of the e-prescribing program, so you not only you could not get the bonus, but you RHCs will not be subject to a reduction in payment for failure to be e-prescribers. So I just wanted to kind of make people aware of that. Now, if you have providers who are delivering services outside of the RHC for which they may bill Medicare Part B through the submission of a 1500 claim form, those 1500 claim forms might potentially be subject, but by and large that's not going to be the case because those 1500, the services they are typically going to bill for under the 1500 claim form are also not subject to the e-prescribing penalty. So we are fairly confident that most rural health clinics and most providers in rural health clinics will see no adverse impact as a result of moving from an incentive-based initiative to a penalty-based initiative as it relates to the physician fee schedule. Another issue that has been looming earlier, late in 2010, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services enacted a policy stipulating that beginning in 2011, all laboratory services, Medicare would no longer pay for a laboratory service unless the requisition for that laboratory service contained the signature of a physician or a qualified non-physician, such as a physician assistant, nurse practitioner, or nurse midwife, as a condition for payment. That policy, shortly after it was announced, came under tremendous scrutiny and objection from the provider community. CMS announced early in 2011 that they were going to suspend the enforcement and application of that policy, go back and re-examine that policy, and make an announcement sometime later as to what they were going to do. Yesterday, CMS announced that they were rescinding the lab signature policy, and they will no longer have that policy on the books. So it reverts back to the policy that was previously in effect, which is there is no requirement for requisitions or requests for laboratory services to contain the signature of a physician, a PA, an NP, or a nurse midwife as a condition for payment. So that hassle factor, if you will, which many providers saw it as a hassle, is no longer out there, and that policy is in the process of being rescinded. They had to announce it as a proposed rule. They have to put it out there for public comment, CMS does, to give people an opportunity to comment. The expectation is that the provider community will near universally support the decision to rescind the policy, and we would expect that in sometime in September the decision to rescind will become official. But CMS has announced that it is their intention to rescind that policy. Those are the issues, Gail, I wanted to take a few minutes to update folks on. I'd like to have Gail is now going to talk to you about a process that is currently undergoing to look at the methodology that is being used to determine whether an area qualifies as a medically underserved area or a health professional shortage area, which, as you all know, is critically important to the Rural Health Clinics program. So, Gail, if you would kind of update us on that process, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Gail Nickerson. I'm on the board of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics and the vice president. I have been the alternate for this process until recently. Our original representative was Ron Nelson, and with his illness and passing, I have tried to step up. I know I can't fill his shoes, but I'm trying to stand in them. And I know on our call today we also have Elia Gallardo. She's another alternate who attends every meeting. She works with the California Primary Care Association. And might be somebody else out there that I don't know. But I wanted to review the process for what we call HPSA, that's Health Professional Shortage Area, and MUA, which is Medically Underserved Area, and MUP, which is Medically Underserved Population. We've been calling it the HPSA-MUP Negotiated Rulemaking Committee. And I would like to provide you some information on the direction of the committee and talk about some of the major factors that are being considered. So a little bit of history. There was a Negotiated Rulemaking Act in 1996 which encouraged the use of negotiation to determine complicated regulations. And that act directed agencies and negotiated rulemaking committees that might be formed to use consensus to the maximum extent possible consistent with law. So that act also set forth requirements for how such a committee, a negotiated rulemaking committee, would be formed. So our negotiated rulemaking process for the HPSAs, MUAs, and MUPs was mandated by Congress in Section 5602 of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010. People call that PPACA. And that law included expectation that this group would be set up to talk about shortage area designation. So it was created after two failed notices of proposed rulemaking that people call NPRMs. One was in 1998, the other was 10 years later in 2008, where regulations were put forward in NPRMs in the Federal Register, and people's comments came in, and there were so many comments, and it was so complicated to try to figure out how to deal with all of that that they let both of those go and decided instead that it was time to set up a negotiated rulemaking committee. And the purpose of the committee is to make sure that the areas, populations, and entities that are going to get designated under the rules And then they become eligible for a variety of federal programs and other resources. We want to make sure that they're truly underserved and or they have workforce shortages so that our resources are devoted to the places that need them the very most. So the committee has a neutral facilitator. Those folks are from HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration. And the committee is attempting to reach that consensus, which is defined as unanimous acceptance. Everybody has to at least be able to live with the decision. The focus of the group is primary care HPSAs, MUAs, and MUPs. We're not talking about mental health HPSAs or dental HPSAs at this point. We're just working on the primary care side of it. And if the committee does reach consensus on all or some of the aspects of the rule, then it will recommend them through Mary Wakefield. She's the HRSA administrator. And Mary would recommend to the Secretary of Health and Human Services that they adopt the committee consensus as the basis for an interim final rule. The meetings have been held in the Washington, D.C. area since September of last year, 2010. The original goal was to submit the final report by July. I sat in by telephone on these meetings. Lots of subcommittees formed to deal with details. Anyway, the timeline kind of ran through and has been now extended, and the revised work plan is to complete the final report by October of this year. The next meeting will be held in Alexandria, Virginia on July 20th and 21st. Meetings are open to the public, and there is a time frame in every meeting for public comment if somebody has that to provide. So in terms of committee membership, I think there are currently 28 members of the committee. Members were chosen for their abilities to represent various interests that are going to be significantly affected by the rule, like rural health clinics. Or they're also on there because they have technical expertise that will be helpful in either defining medical underservice or health profession shortage. So I wanted to kind of give you a picture of what that diverse group is. It includes physicians and other clinicians, the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, NARC, the National Association of Community Health Centers, NAC, the National Rural Health Association, NRHA, the American Hospital Association, AHA, the American Academy of Family Physicians, AAFP. There are also representatives from counties, from state health and primary care offices, and also advocates for special interest groups such as racial and ethnic groups, the disabled, the elderly, patients with HIV or AIDS, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, what we call LGBT. There are also a variety of subcommittees that report back to the committee, and these include groups that are discussing barriers, the weighting of the different factors that we're looking at, implementation, if we do get to an agreement, how do we put that in place, and also discussions about workforce. We have 12 questions that were set out in the PPACA bill that we are addressing, and here are those questions. The first question was, are these objectives of MUA and MUP and HPSA clearly different? Do we need to have two separate processes for medically underserved and health professional shortage? The next question is, the HPSA and MUA-MUP statutes require inclusion of factors that are indicative of health status, ability to pay, access, and availability of health professionals, as well as need. So what should be included? How should it be defined? To what extent should national data sources be used versus state and local resources? What data sources are accurate and reliable enough to use? So what is the provider availability resource? What economic factors influence access, How do we measure that? What health status indicators should be included? What demographic indicators should be included, if there should be any? Then the next question is, what methodology should be used to incorporate the impact of under-service indicators? Should they be combined in the same way for MUA-MUP and HPSA, or should it be different? How about provider availability? Who should we count? Do we include nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and certified nurse midwives? They haven't been included before. If we do include them, how do we define FTE? Is everybody the same? Are doctors different from other providers? How does that work? Should providers in a federal program be counted in the process, or should they be excluded? How do we define rational service areas, what we call RSAs? What population groups should we be considering? What's the role of the facility designations? Right now, there are facility designations that different FQHCs, rural health clinics, correctional facilities have a special facility designation. Perhaps their area isn't considered underserved, but the facility itself is. And how are we going to figure all that out? How should the threshold levels of various indicators be identified to separate those areas such as population groups and facilities that are found to qualify? So, you know, right now we have the threshold, I think, for population to provider is 1 to 3,500. And for underserved populations, it's 1 to 3,000. But if we're going to include other providers, then the thresholds will change. And, you know, where do we put those and what's the right place for all of that? How can the process be designed to reduce the burden of the application and the update process for the states and local entities? Right now, everybody has to go through a process of reestablishing the HPSAs, anyway, on a four-year basis, and there's a lot of work that's involved with that. How can we make that as simple as possible? How can the committee assess the impact of the revised methodologies? How are we going to tell, okay, if we change it this way, how is that going to affect the people that I'm working with, or my area, or my state, or you know, the people that I'm working for? How do we best summarize and display the impact of these methodologies? They're starting to show us maps of that kind of compare the different thresholds and measures. And how can this new methodology be implemented in a manner that would minimize disruption in access? We don't want to suddenly just disqualify a whole bunch of services, because then probably we'll have underservice again. And so those are those 12 questions. The four factors that are being considered, obviously, provider supply is the health professions, the population to provider ratio, P2P. And then there's also health status, outcome, and need. The health status is kind of social determinants. The direct measures of health, like low birth weight, chronic disease like who has diabetes or COPD, and also the barriers, just general access, distance to service. Ability to pay is important. It's clearly a barrier, even if there are services, but you can't access them because you can't pay. And social barriers that, you know, could include racial and ethnic and LGBT and other groups that find it difficult to access service because of certain barriers. So that's pretty much where we are at this point. We are hoping to see the testing come back to show us. Right now they are using counties as the rational service areas because that's where most of the dependable data is available. That's a little problematic for those that are west of the Mississippi, because counties start to get very large as we go west, and they include, you know, cities and frontier areas all in the same county. So it's going to be a little hard to take a look at that, and we're all wondering how it's all going to play out, whether we're going to be able to put our thumbs up or not. But hopefully by October we will have information and we can come up with a consensus. I think that's pretty much my report, Bill, if you want to take
I have a couple questions for you, Gail, before we open it up to the listeners. Can you give us any kind of more insight into some of the thinking with regard to the professionals being counted? Is there seem to be an emerging consensus with respect to including providers other than physicians in the ratios?
I would say yes. I think that there is some agreement. The exactly at what FTE level is still under question. Obviously, a person who is a nurse practitioner and works hard all day says, you know, I'm working full-time here. But that may not exactly pan out in terms of what can be expected in terms of the services that they can provide. I'm not sure, you know, and we're not wanting to insult anybody and wanting to respect everybody's hard work, but still wanting to make sure that we're not going to punish areas that have a lot of nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Now, I think that there is a basic agreement that when these redesignations or designations happen, that rural health clinic and FQHC providers will not be included in the calculation.
And that was the other thing I wanted to ask you to elaborate on, because I know when we've talked with some groups about this and we mentioned that there's a strong likelihood that PAs and NPs in particular would be included in the count, immediately people start doing the calculations and say, well, gee, you know, we'll no longer be a shortage area and we'll lose our rural health clinic designation. Can you elaborate a little bit more on this notion that certain providers would not be counted as part of this this new formula?
Well, yeah, because we're trying to affect what you've called the yo-yo effect for years, we don't want to set up a situation where a place loses its designation because it's managed to bring in, you know, a rural health clinic or an FQHC and is actually serving the needs of the population. But if they went away, the needs wouldn't be met anymore. So it sounds like, you know, from what I hear, that the conversation is that when we do these calculations, we're going to remove these people from the formula so that we're not including the services that could go away if suddenly the area lost its designation.
Okay.
So that so far I understand that to be basically RHCs, FQHCs, J-1 visa doctors.
National Health Service Corps.
Yes, National Health Service Corps.
Okay. You, in talking about the process and the mechanism for achieving consensus, one of the things, how does that affect the National Association of Rural Health Clinics in the event that you do achieve consensus? As I understand, let me back up a second. As I understand it, you will make recommendations to the administrator. You mentioned Mary Wakefield. Mary, in turn, will then make recommendations to the secretary based on the conclusions of the negotiated rulemaking committee. And then the secretary will publish in the Federal Register a notice of proposed rulemaking that we assume will largely reflect the recommendations of the committee.
Right. They actually call it an interim final rule. I'm not sure whether that's a little bit different or not.
It is. It gives it a little bit greater weight in the process as opposed to a negotiated notice of proposed rulemaking. A notice of proposed rulemaking for the audience is really the government is putting it out there and saying, you know, here are our ideas. We want your ideas or we want your reaction. When they do an interim final rule, they are indicating that they've really got a lot more invested, and this is really pretty close to what they want to adopt, but they do want to give the public an opportunity to comment on it. But the likelihood of the outside world making changes may be limited. And part of that, one of the requirements when NARHC agreed to participate, as did all of the organizations, under the negotiated rulemaking, when this comes out as a proposed rule, what is our ability, or can we comment on that, or what are we, are our hands tied?
I think that our part of the deal is that if we come to consensus, then we don't get to argue about it afterwards.
Okay, so we don't get the apple.
But I also want to say that each person at the table does have the right to veto consensus if they truly don't support it, can't support it, can't live with it. They can say that. That's also something.
That was the other point I wanted to get at, that because each organization at the table has the ability to veto, the fact that you didn't exercise that veto when you had the opportunity kind of precludes you from commenting on it when it comes out as that interim final rule.
Correct.
Okay. That's been extremely helpful. Did you have anything, before we open up the lines for questions, did you have anything else you wanted to add, Gail?
I think that's, it's been quite an uphill kind of learning curve for me, and I'm still working on it. But certainly welcome any questions, and if I don't know the answer, I can try to find out.
Well, on behalf of the association and the Rural Health Clinics community, I want to thank you for stepping up and taking on a much more active role than we had anticipated when this process began. Obviously, Ron's passing has created a void, as you noted, but I want to thank Gail for really having to go the extra mile. Literally last week, she was had previously organized a meeting for the California Association of Rural Health Clinics that overlapped with the meeting of the Negotiated Rulemaking Committee, and got on a red-eye flight from California to travel to Washington, D.C. to be able to participate in person. I'd also like to thank John Gill, who has now stepped into the role of alternate because Gail could not make the first day. John traveled from Florida to be able to make sure that our seat was occupied on the first day of the committee meetings. This represents a significant investment of time and effort on the part of the individuals who've been involved in this. And I just want to thank you on behalf of the association and the Rural Health Clinics community for giving up so much of your free time and your work time to be at the table and representing the interests of the Rural Health Clinics community. Operator, at this point, we'd like to open it up to questions. And if you would give the instructions, and we'll take whatever questions folks may have.
Very good. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will request that you record your name for the Q&A session. We ask that you please record your name and location clearly so we may identify your line so you may pose your question. Once again, that is star followed by the number 1 to ask a question, and we will pause for one moment to assemble the queue.
And if there's a regulation that I didn't touch on a policy issue that we didn't touch on that you'd like to raise, certainly feel free, and if we can, we'll try and address questions on something that a regulatory issue that we didn't cover here.
We do have one question at this time that comes from Ralph West. Sir, if you could please state your location before asking your question.
Yes, my name's Ralph West, and I'm calling from Blackfoot, Idaho. Bill, earlier in the presentation today, you mentioned that the e-prescribing requirement, two things, that it won't be an RHC penalty, but that it's still in force and they're now into the penalty phase. We just received some information last week from a consultant that stated that the e-prescribing rule had been moved back to 2014. So where am I up in the night on this?
No, they recently issued some proposed changes to the e-prescribing program to allow for additional exemptions for various categories of providers or types of services, but it is still going into effect on January. The penalties will be applied to services provided after January 1, and it will be based on your reporting of e-prescribing that has occurred between January 1 of 2011 through today.
Right.
If you have to report your data that 6 months, and then the findings of that data will determine whether or not you will be subject to a penalty on your fee schedule payments beginning next January.
Mm-hmm. Okay, where can I get maybe something in writing on that I could get to some people here at my work? What's a good
source? The proposed rule and the changes in the additional exemptions that would apply, or
yeah, mm-hmm. Well, and something that states that it still is enforced, because like I said, this our consultant told us last week you don't need to worry about it. It's been moved back to 2014, and so everybody was breathing this sigh of relief. And so
I'd go back to your consultant and ask you for documentation to that effect. I mean, because what you're asking me to do is prove a negative.
Okay.
I can't send you something that doesn't exist because the date hasn't been changed.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Michael Beaven. Sir, once again, if you could please state your location before asking your question.
South Bend, Washington. I have a question. We live in a rural area, as do most rural health clinics, and I'm finding it more and more difficult to recruit mid-levels to complete the necessity of the rule that you have a mid-level half-time. Are there any regulatory changes coming down the road to help out clinics that are finding it almost impossible to recruit mid-levels when mid-levels leave?
Well, there's already a mechanism in place that NARHC supported and has been in place for several years. If you are a clinic that loses your PA or your nurse practitioner or your nurse midwife, you have an initial 90-day period to replace that individual. If at the end of that 90-day period you are unsuccessful, what the regulations and the statute allow is for a waiver of that staffing requirement, and you can obtain a waiver for up to 1 year in time. So you get to, as you're approaching your 90-day period and you're not successful, you contact your state survey and certification agency and let them know that you would like to get a waiver of the PANP, nurse midwifery, staffing requirement. Those are generally approved as a routine matter. During the course of the year or whatever time frame that you use of that year, you have to be able to demonstrate that you have been seeking to actively recruit to fill that position. If at the end of the one-year waiver period you still have not been able to find a PA or NP or nurse midwife, there is no opportunity to extend the waiver, and you may be asked to show and document what steps you took during the 12-month waiver period to actively recruit. So you do have a fair amount. You can get a fairly lengthy waiver because of the difficulty recruiting. This is something that NARHC actively sought and got approved several years ago. So you really have 15 months to be able to fill that position. And I think the expectation is that, within 15 months, you should be able to fill a position, presuming that you're offering a competitive salary and that you have actively recruited in places where it's likely to be able to find a PA, a nurse practitioner, or a nurse midwife.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
And at this time, there are no questions remaining in the queue. Once again, that is star followed by the number one if anyone else would like to ask a question.
Yeah, we did such a good job, and people are in such shock over the fact that the Rural Health Clinic rule has died that they were popping champagne corks all over the place. Well, if we're not getting any more questions, we don't need to.
We have had a few more questions come in.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Noel Weisswinner.
Go ahead, Noel.
Hi, this is Joel.
Oh, Joel, sorry.
From Wadena, Minnesota. Gail, your comment that in looking at future HPSA and MUA, MUP evaluations, there won't be utilizing the physician or provider count in existing rural health clinics and FUHCs seems to almost ensure that in our most frontier and rural areas that they will be perpetual HPSAs. Because I look at our area, our rational service area, we are essentially a sole source clinic. We are a rural health clinic. There are no non-rural health clinic providers in the whole county. So the process seems to then guarantee perpetuality. Am I missing something?
Well, it sounds like it. I'm kind of waiting to see the testing to see what that shows. The other issue is that it may not be strictly provider to population ratio anymore. Right now, HPSAs are strictly the provider to population ratio. They're talking about factoring in health status indicators of other types. We've had a lot of discussion about how much weight that should have. That's one of the things that we're getting ready to look at. I don't totally know the answer. I don't think we have a guarantee, but I would agree with you that if you truly have an area that doesn't have a lot of providers, you know, unless everybody's in stellar health, the chances are that you would still maintain your certification.
And Joel, one of the
as well as your shortage area designation.
Joel, one of the things. Well, first of all, do you think that would be a bad thing that you would never lose your shortage area designation?
No, that's a good thing.
Another champagne cork to pop.
It feels too good to be true. That's why I'm wondering if we're missing something.
Now, one of the things that we've also talked about in the context of that, because it would create that possibility, is, you know, what would preclude then, let's say you have two rural health clinics in the county and they're the only providers, and then suddenly a third and a fourth and a fifth and a sixth rural health clinic, in theory, could come in there, and suddenly you have a proliferation of providers, all of whom are in rural health clinics, but because of the way the formula is established, the area would still be designated and could have an eighth, a ninth, a tenth. And what we've said is that to give consideration to creating what we would call a level five HPSA. It's an area that is a shortage area, but for the existence of those rural health clinics or F2HCs. And if they were to lose any of those, they would, you know, fall back into a true HPSA, if you will, that in those instances, the government would not look to put additional resources into that area. So, you know, if there were two rural health clinics there and that was, you did your count, you found that the area was no longer qualified, but because they are rural health clinics, we take them out of the count. Well, we wouldn't look to put a third rural health clinic in there. We wouldn't look to put an FQHC in there. We wouldn't look to recruit additional National Health Service Corps, but instead turn and try to direct those resources to areas that don't have providers. And so you don't create another type of problem in order to prevent what Gail described as the yo-yo effect.
If that makes sense. Thank you.
Yep. Next question, operator?
Yes, our next question comes from Libby Coit. And once again, if you could please state your location.
Redfield, Iowa.
I could have told you that.
Hi, Bill. I just wondered. I am drinking. I don't have champagne. I have beer, but that's okay. To the expiration of the rules on Monday. But my concern is: do you have any idea? Does CMS see that after the negotiated rulemaking for HPSAs and MUAs and MUPs is completed, that they will move on toward more rules that would lead to some decertifications into the future? Or not?
I think that there's a certain level of frustration and fatigue on the part of certain folks at the federal level who've been working on these issues for a long time.
Right.
Gail alluded to the fact that the shortage area designation review process has been going on for over 10 years. The rural health clinic rule, for those who've been around long enough, all of this emanates from a statutory change that was done in 1997, so it really goes back 14 years.
Right.
And there are federal employees who've literally been working on some of these things for that long. And they are very frustrated. They're kind of, you know, almost throw their hands up, say, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't want to spend, you know, hours and hours and a lot of my work to see it all just, you know, go down the drain. So I think there's going to be a period of time for decompression and reflection to figure out where do we go from here. NERHC believes that there are areas that are still in need of change in terms of the regulations. We're looking at, we've just started having some discussions about, you know, should we go back and relook at the 97 statutory changes to whether or not they perhaps went too far? Would there be an opportunity to make some modifications to those so that in the event that there was still a desire to have a mechanism to decertify rural health clinics, it might not be as onerous to clinics who've been in the program for a long time. We're looking at our options. So I don't think anybody knows. I do think, though, that having the rural health clinic process now, the rulemaking kind of set aside and giving us the opportunity to see what the shortage area designation rewrite may show is really a better sequencing of the process. That once, assuming that the shortage area designation process is able to go to completion, we'll then have a better idea of what the implications are of the decertification, how many clinics would lose their shortage area designation under the process. And we may find that many clinics that are in jeopardy under the current methodology would be safe under a new methodology.
Right. I just want to thank the National Association of Rural Health Clinics because I think they have really been a beacon of light in this whole process and have been very helpful for all of us who run small little clinics that we think are essential for our communities. And I must say that getting through the rulemaking process and not having to deal with that issue. And now we can start looking at EHR and some of the other things that I think will only strengthen the program. So thank you very much, Bill.
Well, thanks for those kind comments, Libby. The check's in the mail. Tell Ed we said hey.
Uh-huh.
Good. Our next question comes from Teresa Ulrich.
Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Bill. And you know me as Terry. Anyway, my question relates to the EHR incentive that Libby just mentioned, EHRs, so I'll follow up with the question. A recent consultant told me that the EHR incentive for Medicare is totally tied to Part B, and therefore RHCs are not eligible, and I want clarification on that.
Your consultant is correct that the Medicare part of the EHR incentive program is linked to claims submitted using the 1500 claim form. So much as I was saying earlier with some other things with e-prescribing, if your physician, whatever services he, so in your case your husband, provides in your rural health clinic, those services that are billed as rural health clinic services, even though they are for Medicare patients, are not eligible to be used for an EHR calculation because you bill using a UB. However, to the extent that your husband, who's a physician, generates Part B claims for non-RHC services delivered to a Medicare patient, so, for example, he goes to see a patient in the hospital, or he provides other Medicare services, Part B, that are not RHC, those claims could be used for generating an EHR incentive payment through the Medicare program. But our expectation is that the bulk of the rural health clinic providers will qualify for an EHR incentive payment through the Medicaid part of the EHR incentive, where there is a specific program geared for providers who work in rural health clinics.
Okay. That was my understanding, too, but I wanted your expertise on it. Thank you. And I second her in telling everyone what a wonderful organization NARHC is, and I'm a strong supporter.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here.
And we have one question remaining in queue at this time. That comes from Ron Rain.
Hi. Go ahead, Ron.
Hi, this is Ron Rain in Colville, Washington. Hey, I got on the call a little bit late, and I understand about the EHR incentive payments on the Medicare side. On the Medicaid side, just making sure that the threshold is still 30% Medicaid patients.
Actually 30% needy, not 30% Medicaid for rural health clinic providers.
Okay.
Which is a combination of your Medicaid, your SCHIP, your any patients that you see for whom you provide free care based upon their ability to pay, or any patients you provide reduced cost care based on a sliding fee scale that you've established for individuals based on their income.
You know how many people are going to be, what's your sense on the number of people that are going to be able to qualify for that?
There's been a sporadic, what we're finding is that it's varying from state to state. Gail, for example, is in California. They have, she's with Adventist. They have a large network of, I believe, in excess of 30 rural health clinics in three different states, Gail?
Yes.
And how many of your clinics, I think you had told me you thought they would all qualify?
We think
all of your providers in your rural health clinics would qualify?
Some of them work in other locations as well, but that,
okay,
that would be our main barrier because we see lots of Medicaid patients.
Okay. As we've heard from providers in other states where either the Medicaid program is not as robust or they don't see large numbers of uninsured or uncompensated care where they may have difficulty meeting the threshold. The University of Southern Maine is currently doing an analysis to try and come up with better data on how many rural health clinics will be able to qualify on the 30% needy threshold. We at the national level are looking at whether or not there's an opportunity to modify the threshold, either to lower the threshold to a different number, something lower than 30%, or that the threshold would be raised but allow you to calculate your Medicare populations into a higher threshold. So those are some things that are being looked at. The one other thing I would say is I would encourage folks to look very closely at the opportunity this presents to establish a sliding fee scale. There are no parameters on the type of sliding fee scale that you establish, and there's no limitation on how high of a sliding fee scale that you can establish, nor the amount of the discount that you provide, particularly to individuals who are on the upper end of the sliding fee scale. So, for example, you could establish a sliding fee scale that made a discount available to individuals in your community who had incomes up to 400% of poverty, which mirrors some of the provisions that are in the Affordable Care Act. And you could provide them with a relatively small discount, 2, 3, 4, 5% on that upper end of your sliding fee scale. And at 400% of poverty for a family of four, you would be allowing individuals to qualify for a small discount who are making close to $100,000 a year. So that by providing a very small financial discount, those individuals would then all be able to be counted towards meeting your 30% needy threshold and potentially create an opportunity for you to be able to qualify. So look at, don't just look at your Medicaid and your CHIP patients, but look to see whether or not there's an opportunity to establish a sliding fee scale, certainly that would be robust for your low income, those individuals who are below 100% of poverty, for whom you may already be providing a discount or not aggressively seeking to obtain payment, but that would also allow individuals on higher levels of the income scale to qualify, but for whom the financial hit, the amount of the discount, if you will, that you would be giving them on your sliding fee scale would be relatively small, such that you would be able to qualify because now more patients could be counted towards that 30% threshold.
And that would have to be with, there would be need to be uninsured, correct?
No, they don't have to be uninsured.
Oh, okay. So you could do the sliding scale even if they have an insurance.
As long as, yeah, whatever you set it up, that you would say, for example, my charges are $100, and you have to have consistent charges. But if you're at 400% of poverty, we will accept 98% of charges. So your insurance company, their insurance company pays whatever it pays. The copay, instead of it being $20, you collect $18 in a copay. So they qualified for your sliding fee scale. You lost $22. I'm sorry, you lost $2, but you may have enough patients. Now suddenly you reach your 30% threshold, and now you're going to qualify for $64,000 per provider for an EHR incentive.
Now you're talking. Okay, good idea. Now, the next thing is on the e-prescribing payments, the basically the penalty. I was just kind of following up on a previous question. Now, that was really is for non-rural health clinic visits as well, right?
I'm sorry, say your question again.
On the e-prescribing, basically this penalty that's coming about, you know, we have to do
that. It's all tied to claims that are submitted using a 1500 claim form.
Perfect. And the last thing is 340B pricing program. Is there any opportunity for us to get RHCs on the 340B pricing?
Well, that requires a legislative change. We have had those conversations with several members of Congress. I think there's some sympathy within the Congress. I will tell you that the pharmaceutical industry is very much opposed to further expansion of the 340B program. So we will continue to have it as something on our wish list, but I would say that the likelihood of it happening is not very high.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're doing a fine work out there.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the kind comments.
Bye-bye.
Any other questions, operator?
And there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, I think we're right up on our hour, so we did a good job of stretching this out. So I want to thank everybody for taking the time to participate. If there was a topic, as I said, that we didn't cover here in terms of the regulatory, send me a question to info@narhc.org with your questions, or if you have a suggestion for a topic for the future. We want to thank everyone for your participation and wish you a wonderful day. And keep providing great quality care to your communities and doing the wonderful job you're doing. Thank you all.
Happy holiday.
And this does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation and have a wonderful day.